Good afternoon. Welcome back to Track D, the transactional track. If you intended to be in the patent or trademark tracks, you're in the wrong place. If you want to talk about drugs, you're in the right place. Seeing everyone staying here, that's good and scary, but the drug of choice that we picked in the hallway is marijuana. And we're lucky to have some of the foremost experts in and around the subject matter here in Colorado, Pamela Hirschman, Todd Blakely, and Kelly Rosenberg, and they are most excellent in many ways, but rather than hear me talk about them, let's hear what they have to say. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ryan.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Kelly Rosenberg. I am a senior associate at a law firm called Vicente Cederberg here in Denver. We have offices around the country, and we do all aspects of marijuana law. We lobby, we write regs for different countries and states and municipalities. We represent industry members in getting licensed and keeping their licenses when they get in trouble and things of that nature. Prior, I just started here at my new law firm in April of this year, and prior to that, I had been at the Colorado Office of the Attorney General for 9 years, and I had initially my first assignment there as I regulated the I represented the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and oil and gas is a really highly regulated industry. And in 2010, when marijuana became legal in Colorado at the business level, I was switched over to represent the Marijuana Enforcement Division, because marijuana is also a highly regulated industry. And so I did that for 6 years and just switched over to my new law firm about a month and a half ago. I'm going to provide a little context to give a little background about marijuana in Colorado and how it's regulated. And then I'm not a trademark lawyer or a patent lawyer, so I don't have a lot to offer in that regard, but I will provide a little context to provide some framework for this discussion. As many people don't know, Colorado legalized or actually decriminalized the medical use of marijuana in 2000 via what is known as Amendment 20 in the Colorado Constitution. And it exempts certain acts from criminal law, provides affirmative defenses in certain instances, and the scope of the amendment continues to evolve. For instance, in the year 2000, edibles were not considered at all, and edibles are a big deal now in Colorado. And so the scope of the amendment is much different than it was initially anticipated to be. So medical marijuana existed in the state of Colorado relatively quietly from 2000 to 2009. Patients, primary caregivers, and their physicians, which are governed by Amendment 20, functioned with little to no regulation. In 2009, things began to change. And that is when the era of the dispensary began. And there were a variety of factors that played into the reason why suddenly in 2009, Colorado, in Denver in particular, had an incredible amount of marijuana dispensaries. There was an administrative law case where the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment was determined to have unconstitutionally promulgate a certain rule. So that was the Lagoy case. A particular administrative rule was overturned. The Ogden Memorandum came out, which was a memo from a chief U.S. prosecutor to the different U.S. attorneys telling them to make medical marijuana cases the lowest prosecutorial priority. There was a bad economy, so there was lots of empty retail space, and there was absolutely no regulation over these businesses. In 2010, the Colorado General Assembly responded to this massive growth of medical marijuana dispensaries, and the Medical Marijuana Enforcement Division was created. The Medical Marijuana Enforcement Division regulated, still continues to regulate, all aspects of medical marijuana businesses. It licenses the grows, the retail stores, the edible manufacturers, and it regulated all of the owners and employees of these medical marijuana businesses. And the Medical Marijuana Enforcement Division was my client until about a month ago. And in 2010 to 2012, there was a lot of litigation. The marijuana community in Colorado is very litigious, and it has a lot to do with the fact that many of them operated without any regulation. And so it's sort of like trying to hoard cats because suddenly all of these businesses who operated with no oversight are suddenly subjected to hundreds of different rules governing everything imaginable. And so, and then because it was in the Colorado Constitution initially, and it still is, the medical marijuana constitutional amendment is separate and distinct from the statutory medical marijuana code. However, there was a lot of litigation with people challenging the state of Colorado saying they had a constitutional right to their medical marijuana, and they were never successful in any of those claims. In 2012, as many people know, the Colorado Constitution was amended again, and this time recreational marijuana was outright legalized. It legalizes small amounts of marijuana for all individuals the ages 21 and over. The constitutional amendment itself placed mandates on the Colorado Department of Revenue to implement certain rules by a certain date. Otherwise, the Colorado Department of Revenue would lose all regulatory oversight. It prohibits any rule governing a retail marijuana business from being unreasonably impracticable. Although it unreasonably impracticable is defined to say something to the effect of a prudent businessman wouldn't go into a business if this rule were in effect, but the question we always had was, we don't really know what prudent businessman would go into the business of doing something that was totally federally illegal, but anyway. The amendment itself contemplates extra taxes, sales and excise taxes, to be put upon the marijuana transactions. And that amendment is also continually being challenged by litigation. A lot of people talk about, just anecdotally, recreational marijuana being a lot more expensive than medical marijuana, and that is because of the extra taxes. There's an excise tax, and then in Denver, I think it has a 25% sales tax total on top of the regular sales tax that you find at both the city and state level. So it's recreational marijuana is a lot more expensive for that reason. And in 2013, the Colorado General Assembly enacted the retail marijuana code. So now we have two statutes, the medical marijuana code, the retail marijuana code, and two constitutional amendments that all govern the marijuana regime in Colorado. In 2013, the Medical Marijuana Enforcement Division converted to the Marijuana Enforcement Division. And in addition to regulating all of the medical marijuana businesses, the Colorado Department of Revenue now regulates all of the retail. Recreational marijuana is legally referred to as retail marijuana, so sorry for the confusion. And in addition to regulating the grows, the storefronts, the edibles manufacturers, the owners and employees of the businesses, the Colorado Department of Revenue also from day one started regulating marijuana testing labs. And actually just this last year, now medical marijuana testing labs exist as well. In 2013, the medical marijuana rules underwent extensive amendments, and the first retail marijuana rules were adopted. The rule topics, there are 15 different series of rule topics, from general rules to rules governing the retail storefront specifically, specific rules for the grows or cultivations, specific rules for the testing facilities, transportation and storage rules, labeling rules, advertising rules, disciplinary rules, testing rules, and now it's them. We have rules that govern everything, and as I said, I was just providing some context so you have a little framework. I will say at the outset, sorry for this awkward transition, sorry about that. When I represented the Marijuana Enforcement Division, I never once encountered a scenario where a trademark issue was ever brought to the Colorado Department of Revenue's attention. There is a statutory provision that requires that all of the licensees not violate trademark rules, and it's explicit. You can't have pot tarts, things like, you know, the ganja joy instead of almond joy. You can't do that sort of thing anymore. But that was never an enforcement issue for the state of Colorado. Thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Pamela Hirschman, and I'm a shareholder with the firm of Sheridan Ross in Denver, and I'll be talking to you about the commercialization of marijuana and trademark rights. As many of you most likely already know, in order to obtain a federal trademark registration with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the mark must be in lawful use in commerce. This means that the products or services that are offered under the mark must be legal goods and services in trade. As Kelly has already explained, marijuana was legalized in Colorado for medical purposes in 2000 when the Colorado voters approved the Amendment 20 to the Constitution. Again, in the summer of 2010, the Colorado Medical Marijuana Code was enacted, regulating Colorado businesses in the medical marijuana industry. Interestingly, in the summer of 2010, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office added medical marijuana to its acceptable identification of goods and services manual. The exact phrase that was in the ID manual was processed plant matter for medicinal purposes, namely medical marijuana. I should mention that in 2010, the District of Columbia also legalized medical marijuana, and that likely had something to do with the PTO's decision to put medical marijuana in the ID manual. Following this, not surprisingly, numerous parties were filing applications for medical marijuana with very unique trademarks such as Mary Jane and Maui Wowie. In the fall of 2010, the PTO determined that the addition of medical marijuana to the ID manual was a mistake, and they did something that is very rare for the trademark office. They offered refunds to all of the applicants who had filed the medical marijuana applications. Well, where does that leave us today? There are 24 states in the District of Columbia that have legalized marijuana in some form. So if you were to file an application for a mark covering marijuana, the product, or the retail sale of marijuana, what would happen? That application would be refused because it is in violation of the federal law, specifically the Controlled Substances Act or the CSA. The CSA prohibits the manufacturing, distributing, dispensing, or possessing certain controlled substances, including marijuana, and it prohibits the sale of any product which is primarily intended or designed for use in manufacturing, processing, ingesting, inhaling, or otherwise introducing into the human body a controlled substance. If you were to file an application based on use of a mark for medical marijuana or the retail sale of marijuana, that application would be refused under the CSA because it is a violation of the CSA to be selling those products. If you were to file an intent to use application for marijuana or the retail sale of marijuana, the application would be refused because there is no bona fide intent to lawfully use the trademark in commerce. Some examples of applications that were denied for this reason are the Marijuana Whisperer for medical marijuana dispensary or MMJ for cannabis. Both of these applications involved products and services for possessing and distributing marijuana, which obviously is a violation of the CSA. However, all hope is not lost for businesses in the marijuana industry. There are some exceptions to this rule that would allow trademark owners to get registrations of trademark rights in the marijuana industry. The product would have to, or service would have to not involve possession or distribution of marijuana. Or for drug paraphernalia, the prohibition on the sale of equipment on drug paraphernalia under the CSA does not apply to any person authorized by local, state, or federal law to manufacture, possess, or distribute such items, and any item that in the normal lawful course of business is imported, exported, transported, or sold through the mail, or by any other means, and traditionally intended for use with tobacco products, including any pipe, paper, or accessory. Some examples of trademarks that reference marijuana that were registered for lawful products include High Times for books about cannabis. Some of you may have been familiar with the High Times magazine, which is also about cannabis. High Times owns approximately 10 registrations for the High Times mark. This came up in litigation within the last couple of years. There was a lovely man named Richard Reimers in Seattle, Washington, who decided to open a dispensary titled High Time Station Dispensary, and Trans High Corporation, the owner of the High Times mark, sued him for trademark infringement. Mr. Reimers asserted a counterclaim for cancellation of the High Times registration on the basis that the products with which it's registered are unlawful goods in trade because magazines contain advertisements promoting the sale of marijuana. The court disagreed with Mr. Reimers' claim, mainly in part because the advertisement and promotion of marijuana is not a violation of the CSA. The Trans High Corp also is the owner of the U.S. Cannabis Cup. The U.S. Cannabis Cup is registered for t-shirts and sweatshirts. The U.S. Cannabis Cup also holds exhibits about marijuana, and they were also able to obtain a registration for the holding of exhibits about marijuana. There's a registration for Best Buds for software for medical and recreational marijuana dispensaries to use to promote their products with their customers. Some examples of trademarks that have been registered in connection with services in the marijuana industry include leafhead.com for chat room services in the field of cannabis in the medical and recreational marijuana industries, CannaCard for business consultation in the medical and recreational marijuana industry, and GrowHouse for online journals, namely blogs featuring information relating to the marijuana industry. With respect to the exceptions to the CSA for drug paraphernalia, because of this exception, trademark owners that are selling drug paraphernalia such as vaporizer pens should be able to obtain registration of that mark for a vaporizer pen. This is because the manufacture, possession, and distribution of electronic cigarettes and vaporizer pens are authorized by the laws of several states, including Colorado, and such products are traditionally intended for use with legal tobacco products. One example of a mark that was registered in connection with vaporizer pens is Kush Queen. However, applicants for these types of products should be prepared to receive at least one office action inquiring into whether or not their products are in violation of the CSA. Due to the fact that trademark owners cannot obtain a federal registration for a mark that covers marijuana or the retail sale of marijuana, there are no federal trademark infringement lawsuits may be filed by a plaintiff whose trademark rights are based solely on the possession or distribution of marijuana. So what can trademark owners do in the marijuana industry? Well, they primarily will need to rely on state law to assert their trademark rights. If the trademark happens to be a unique design or logo, they could also try copyright protection to assert their rights, since copyright rights are not based on whether or not that design is used with any particular product. This chart is a list of all the states that currently have approved medical marijuana for use, and the right column indicates whether or not they've also improved recreational use of marijuana. In Colorado, there are no prohibitions on obtaining trademark registration for trademarks currently in use with marijuana or the retail sale of marijuana. Some examples of marks that have been registered are How We Roll for cannabis cigarettes, and Dank Bank for the retail store services featuring top-level cannabis. The majority of states in which marijuana is legal do not review trademark applications substantively. However, you should be aware that there are some that do, such as California. And in California, currently only medical marijuana is legal. So if an applicant were to file an application that broadly covered marijuana, it would likely be refused because that would be too broad, since recreational marijuana is not yet legal. Some other Colorado laws that are relevant that you should be aware of are the Colorado packaging, labeling, and advertising laws. Packaging for marijuana products may not be designed to appeal to children, and advertising targeting out-of-state consumers are prohibited. Another statute of note is this Colorado revised statute provision, which Kelly mentioned briefly. The language, which is right here, retail marijuana products manufacturers shall not add any marijuana to a food product where the manufacturer of the food product holds a trademark to the food product's name. Retail marijuana products manufacturers shall not intentionally or knowingly label or package a retail marijuana product in a manner that would cause a reasonable consumer confusion as to whether the retail marijuana product was a trademarked food product, and they cannot label or package a product in any manner that violates trademark law. The practical effect of this is that cannabis companies should be very wary about attempting to obtain a federal trademark registration for a non-cannabis-infused edible product and then use the same mark on a cannabis-infused edible product. I do not know whether or not this would apply to trade dress, but that does raise an interesting question about that as well, and we just have to see how that plays out. I'm now going to turn this over to Todd to talk to you about patents.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name's Todd Blakely. I'm also a shareholder at Sheridan Ross with Pamela. Glad you could turn out. I am going to, as she said, talk about patents primarily, but I'm going to take a step back for a second. Our firm does work in this space, but before we did, we went out and hired good ethics counsel to get us an opinion of what we can and can't and shouldn't do. And so to the extent you're considering working in this space, I would highly recommend you do that, just as a little bit of a side note. So I'm going to talk about the patent space. The CSA really doesn't apply as difficult or isn't as applicable in the patent space as it is in the trademark space. To the extent you're patent practitioners, there isn't any use in commerce requirement to get a patent. And in fact, there are earliest patents I can find issued by the patent office go back to the 1940s. And in fact, the US government owns patents on marijuana. So, generally speaking, there aren't any prohibitions on getting patents in the marijuana space. And so let me give you some examples here. I'm going too fast. So processes and research. These are issued patents, making extract, processing the cannabis, getting intermediate compounds. You can get patents on deliverables and consumables. Chocolates with cannabinoids, who doesn't want that? Cooking spreads and oils and things. So all these, again, are transdermal delivery. Chewing gum was the last one. You can get patents in the area of law enforcement, identifying beverages that have cannabis or locks on your car, similar to alcohol, oral detection. You can get patents on growing. Cannabis, and it doesn't necessarily have to be cannabis, hydroponics and things like that. You can have vertical grow systems that, again, don't necessarily apply directly or solely to cannabis. In the healthcare side of things, you can certainly, and that's part of the medical marijuana research shows, at least some research shows there are benefits to the CBD aspects of marijuana as opposed to the psychedelic THC side of the plant, and from what my personal understanding is, there are lots of CBD elements that haven't even been identified yet. So it's a ripe area on the chemistry side, chemical processing to identify those aspects of the drug and the benefits that come with that. Business processes. Somebody tried, you know, in the United States of America, let's get a commodities market on marijuana. So somebody filed a patent application on setting up a commodities trading exchange. That didn't get rejected because of it was based on marijuana. That got rejected under business methods in 101. That went down in flames, as everything seems to be doing in the business methods area these days. But so that's probably something you can't get a patent on. You can also get design patents, as you would expect. Those are some examples. A vaporizer, why somebody would spend money to get a speaker cone with, and you can't see it very well, it has campus designs on the speaker cone, who knows, but somebody did. Oil diffusers and things like that, again, pretty straightforward, no restrictions there. Where there are some oddities are in the plant patent area. A plant patent doesn't require you submit an actual specimen of the plant. You can get away with photographs, but the patent office can, at some point if they want to, ask you to submit a specimen of the actual plant. These are pending applications, and there's a long history here. These applications actually got rejected under 112 grounds, and that's kind of identified here. And they got rejected on 112 grounds because the application itself, the specification, didn't identify within the specification how you can reproduce and create the plant. It discussed the plant and a lot of attributes of the plant, but it didn't say how some person in the public could obtain that plant and create it themselves. And there is a solution to that, and the patent laws allow that. In that case, if you submit the plant, a specimen of the plant itself to the patent office, that will get overcome your 112 rejection. But that then creates the conundrum. How do you deliver a plant that is otherwise illegal under the CSA to the patent office, which is in Virginia, which doesn't allow or hasn't approved any sales or use of marijuana recreationally or medically? I don't know the answer to that. You cannot, I know you cannot, if you're a practitioner in Colorado, tender it to the Colorado branch of the patent office. None of the satellite offices will accept submissions or filings. So it's got to be submitted in Virginia. I don't know how this practitioner is going to overcome that, but he's either going to not be able to do it and lose his rights, or he's going to have a potential problem with possession. And that's one of the points I make here. CSA, as Pamela noted, has an issue, has it's illegal to possess marijuana. And as a patent attorney, possession, you know, doesn't necessarily mean you have to have the physical thing. You can have the idea, and as long as you describe it in detail such that it's ready for patenting under the patent laws, you then possess the invention. So those things have different meaning, but in the context of a plant patent, perhaps not. Perhaps there's a issue that as a practitioner you might have to face with submitting a specimen if the Patent and Trademark Office requires or asks you to do so. That's a comparison of the ethics rules for the state of Colorado on the right and the federal rules on the left. And again, as an aside, in Colorado, we have the rule on the left, a lawyer shall not counsel a client to engage or assist a client in conduct that the practitioner knows is criminal. Colorado Supreme Court reduced the restrictions and allows a lawyer to assist a client in conduct the lawyer believes is permitted by constitutional provisions. So under Colorado law, we lawyers who are licensed by the state of Colorado have a little more latitude in our representation of clients that are in the marijuana business. But also as intellectual property lawyers, if you do any litigation, you practice in federal court, and the federal rules are much more restrictive. And the PTO has the same rules as our federal court here in Colorado does. As I said a few minutes ago, the patents in this field have been issued since the 1940s, and I know of no sanction or action taken by the patent office or the U.S. government against lawyers filing patent applications and obtaining issued patents through the patent office. So I take some comfort personally in the fact that the patent office has had lots of opportunities to say to us as practitioners, no, you shouldn't be doing this, and haven't done so yet, to at least to my knowledge. I'm not going to try to get to be too ethical here, but I've got these last couple slides, I've got some cases that might be of interest to talk about. The first one is a trademark case, and the point that I was, and it's Purple Heart was the name of the dispensary, and the organization that promotes Purple Hearts on behalf of the military sued or sent a cease and desist letter to the dispensary saying stop using Purple Heart. The dispensary filed a declaratory judgment action, the point I draw from that, is, at least as a practitioner, is if you're representing a company in the marijuana industry, it's certainly acceptable for you to, if an allegation of wrongdoing is asserted against you, in this case, you're accused of infringing someone's trademark, you can go to court and file a declaratory judgment action saying, no, we're not infringing, and presumably won't be sanctioned as an attorney in the sense of assisting a business that's potentially violating federal law. This one is, no, Northern District of California. It's a federal case. And the second one is not an IP case at all. It's a Southern District of New York federal case that a fight between investors and, well, a group of people got together to create a marijuana business. There were the people that knew how to grow marijuana and cultivate it. And then they brought in investors, and then they brought in some people with business acumen to help grow and flourish the business. They got into a dispute over who had ownership rights, and that led to this breach of contract case. And so everybody was fighting over who owned the marijuana business. And again, in this New York case, the trial court didn't have any trouble with the lawyers bringing these actions or defending or asserting claims on behalf of either of the parties or any of the parties. And both California and New York have more restrictive ethical rules than Colorado does. Let's see here. So if you, let's say you have a patent and you're going to assert it against someone in the marijuana space. One of the things that comes up in the remedies that you have as a patent litigator are monetary relief and injunctive relief. And if you're seeking injunctive relief, those who seek equity must do equity, and you get into the whole potential of unclean hands. There are no patent cases that I can find at all, but by analogy, there are some bankruptcy cases where companies have sought protection of the bankruptcy laws, which is a federal jurisdiction. And in one case, it was in Arizona bankruptcy court. In Arizona, I think unique to, that's different from Colorado is that all the marijuana businesses there have to be nonprofit. And so because of that state law, a whole side business grew up of companies who would manage marijuana businesses, and the marijuana business would then hire them as vendors to come in and manage their shop, and then they would pay the management company for all the work, and they would be able to siphon off all their profits, and they'd be a nonprofit. That was, in essence, the way it worked. In this particular case, the management company owned the trademarks for the products and licensed the trademarks to the retail dispensary and was getting, I think, $8,000 a month as their trademark license. And that management business was the one that sought protection in bankruptcy court. And the Arizona judge basically said two things. One, your petition in bankruptcy has to be denied because if I allow this to go forward, I have to appoint a trustee, a federal appointee, to run your marijuana business. And so I'll be setting up the trustee to be immediately violating federal law as soon as he takes over and starts running your business. So A, I can't do it on that ground. And the second ground was unclean hands. You guys, all of you that are parties to this bankruptcy action, know that you're violating federal law. And I, as a federal bankruptcy judge sitting in judgment of you, can't condone that. And so he threw out the bankruptcy petition on unclean hands grounds as well. So the potential exists in our space. If you go to court starting and assert patent rights and your client is in the marijuana business as opposed to some non-marijuana business that owns patents in this space, unclean hands could be a defense that could be used against you. Anecdotally, there was another case in that ended up in the Ninth Circuit, a California case. A marijuana business hired a lawyer, gave him a $25,000 retainer to be on call to defend them if they ever got into any trouble. The lawyer misspent the funds, absconded with them. And then when they sued him, he filed a petition in bankruptcy saying, hey, I don't have any money, discharge all these obligations I have. And the district court originally threw it out and said, you're right, both of you have unclean hands. I'm going to discharge the bankruptcy petition, and otherwise, let the lawyer get away with stealing the client's funds. And the Ninth Circuit said, no. You have to balance unclean hands here. And in this case, it's much more of a public policy interest for the public to have faith in their lawyers. They aren't going to steal their money, as opposed to a marijuana business. So the Ninth Circuit reversed. The last point there is probably the most interesting case that's come out in this area, and it's by our chief judge here in Colorado, Judge Krieger, and it's an insurance case. And so a Colorado Springs pot shop, or actually a grow house, growing marijuana, and when the Waldo Canyon fire of a few years ago happened, the smoke and all from the fire clogged up their ventilation system, and which caused ultimately indirectly damage to the plants in the grow house. Didn't burn them down, but it caused damage to them. And the grow house said to their insurer, we've had this damage, pay us under our policy. And the insurer said, no, don't think so. And one of the defenses, there were a lot of defenses relating to policy coverage and stuff, such, but one of the defenses was that it's against public policy. A defense the insurance company raised was contracts to insure plants that are otherwise illegal under the CSA is against public policy. The insurance company didn't make that argument directly. They kind of inferentially went to the judge and said, you know, here's a advisory opinion we'd like you to address. And Judge Krieger said, first, no, I'm not going to address advisory opinions. Secondly, that if that's the way you're going to go, insurance company, I will allow the plaintiff to amend the claim, their complaint, insert all kind of fraud claims against you, because you know went into this knowingly and with your eyes open, and you contracted with them. But of most interest was, in responding to the public policy argument, Judge Krieger said, basically that the federal government, since 2009, has been so far all over the board on not having a clear and consistent policy in the area of marijuana, that the federal government is erratic in its position on whether this is allowable or isn't allowable under federal law. She threw up her hands and said, there's no way, given the state of our current federal policy, that I'm going to decide anything adverse on grounds of public policy in the marijuana space. So that isn't directly applicable to anything we do, but I think you can take some comfort in it, and at least that our chief judge is saying that because the federal government doesn't have a clear position and in fact has been sending signals that it's okay to operate and have businesses in the marijuana space because the federal government isn't going after them and prosecuting them, that we as practitioners, I think, can take some comfort, I don't want to overstate it, but some comfort that in representing these businesses, we're not acting unethically. So that's the gist of what I had to say in this area. If you guys have any questions for any of us, please speak up. Yes, sir.
I guess it's preparing for the future. The DEA might reclassify cannabis.
So I have to repeat the question. So should marijuana be reclassified from a class one to a class two drug? How do we see that as affecting IP or even non-IP? Do you have any thoughts on that? I don't think it changes anything from the IP perspective. I think it's still a scheduled drug, just it's a different class. It's still a class two drug. I don't think that changes the legality of it. I think it may change the criminal penalties, but I don't think it changes it and makes it and decriminalizes it completely. So I don't think it changes anything from the IP perspective.
From an enforcement perspective, I think that it could ultimately make things a lot cleaner, but be very chaotic at the outset. For one thing that comes to mind for me is the states now step into the shoes of the federal government when they're regulating all aspects of marijuana. Pesticide use is a big issue with marijuana right now, and typically if somebody violates a Pesticide Applicators Act for a state, it gets referred out to the FDA and or the USDA, and we don't have the federal overlay that we do. So from the state's perspective, I think it would help things ultimately, because then there could be some clear guidance about those types of issues. But at the outset, I think it would be pretty chaotic. And then where marijuana could be transported to and from could be pretty confusing initially and things of that nature, because in addition to Virginia not allowing marijuana, you can't have it cross state lines or put it in a U.S. Postal Service package legally either. So all of those sorts of things would change. I think ultimately it could help make things smoother, but pretty chaotic at the outset.
Yep. So the question was about the Colorado revised statute provision that says you cannot use or I don't remember the exact language, but can't have the food product for the free trademark food product using the same trademark on a cannabis edible type product. And the question is, does that apply to marks owned by the same company or if it's just different companies? And the law does not say that it only applies to trademarks of another company. So if you read what the way the language is in the law, it could very easily apply to trademarks for from the same company. And I think the purpose of this law was to prevent, it wasn't for trademark reasons, it was to prevent consumers from being confused about what they're ingesting. You didn't want consumers thinking that they were eating something that did not contain cannabis and it actually did. So it was a consumer protection law, but it has trademark implications. Kelly, do you want to add?
I agree.
Kelly agrees.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So you're asking if they used a registered trademark on a edible product and the registered mark for
was obviously for some other.
So a company that currently owns a registration for a food product then decides to use that mark on a cannabis product. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that would be grounds for cancellation unless that company was not using the mark on products that did not contain cannabis. So on the federal level, the question is whether or not that registration is valid. Are the goods that are covered by that registration lawful goods in trade? So if that company is still selling product under that mark without cannabis in it, there's no issue with that trademark registration. It would be a violation of the Colorado law, but it wouldn't affect the state federal registration. So the question was, what leeway does the trademark office examiners have to look and see if the goods potentially are in violation of the CSA or relating to marijuana? And just for your reference, I am a former trademark examiner, used to work at the PTO as an examiner, and I know a little bit about the leeway that the examiners are given, and they can search whatever they want. So if there's any indication in the application that that product is related to marijuana, the examiner is probably going to go search for it. So if the mark has cannabis in it, if there's a leaf, they're going to start searching. We represented clients that have vaporizer pens, and we don't say anything about cannabis in there. We actually list electronic cigarettes typically in the identification. And electronic cigarettes in and of themselves, there's no indication that cannabis is involved. But the examiners will go and do a search and not only find our client's website, but other third-party websites that are commenting on our client's product and whether or not there's any relation to cannabis. And then we'll get the office action asking for further information. Does this product, or is this product used to ingest marijuana? Does this product violate the CSA? And you have to respond to that.
Trademark after this.
So the question is how to establish your earlier trademark priority rights, if assuming that this all does become legal and you are able to maintain the federal registration for marks covering marijuana. That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure how that's going to play out. I would think that you are all starting from scratch. Potentially, you'll have some state rights. If you were using the mark in various states that allowed for legalization of marijuana, perhaps there will be be some allowance for that. I don't know how it's going to play out, if they're going to say, well, this is retroactive, so if you've been using the mark since 1940, you can claim that as your first use. We just have to see what the PTO decides to do. That's actually a very good question, and there are some registrations currently. Well, first, let me repeat the question. He was asking if the change from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2 will make a difference, because that's essentially saying that marijuana could be used for medicinal purposes. And currently, there are some registered trademarks that contain CBD in the pharmaceutical. It's an FDA-approved product, and the owners of those marks were able to obtain a registration. So that is the case currently. So I assume, obviously, that would be the case going forward. But you do have to have FDA approval for that if you have a client that's interested in registering a mark that's covering a marijuana pharmaceutical. They would have to go through the whole FDA trial and get approval. They couldn't just say that this is a drug.
For medical marijuana.
Right.
Join me in thanking our panelists.